Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim for the next Economist Mom segment, and then New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute policy analyst Phil Sletten will join me to wrap up the show. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Santa may be dropping coal in some additional stockings this holiday season if Congress is not able to resolve a partisan standoff over border wall funding and avoid a partial government shutdown due to 7 unfinished spending bills. Elected leaders have only completed 5 of the 12 days of Christmas, ho ho ho. The current continuing resolution runs out on Friday, December 21st. If another is not passed or a broader deal is not struck on the 7 remaining bills, the upcoming holiday would result in a furlough for more than 380,000 federal workers. More than 420,000 others would be forced to work without pay until a shutdown ends. Such a shutdown, although only about 25% of the total government, would still lead to significant disruption in some services, such as the processing of loans for small businesses, agricultural assistance, and energy leasing permits. House Republicans scuttled their push last week to bring forward a bill containing another tax package before losing their majority in the next Congress, out of concern that the upcoming holiday could impact the attendance of elected leaders and reduce its likelihood of passage. The tax package was projected to cost about $80 billion over the next decade. There may no longer be time to bring forward the bill before the end of the year, which means portions of it may end up in a year-end spending bill that funds the rest of the government. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for the next edition of our Economist Mom segment. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. Diane and Bob are both regular contributors on the show. Welcome back both to our next Economist Mom segment.
Thanks, Chase.
Delighted to be back.
We're very deep into the holiday season right now, so I thought it would be fitting to have a Christmas or holiday-themed Economist Mom segment. And I think it is especially timely because we have the Congressional Budget Office's report on options to reduce the nation's debt. And I thought it'd be fun to go over our own little 12 days of Christmas as it pertains to some of those options. And basically, I'm going to be the guinea pig by presenting 12 CBO options that I could potentially stomach and share their projected savings. And you guys get to pick me apart and decide whether the options make me a Scrooge or make me a Santa. But before we dive into that aspect of the segment, I want to have you both sort of kick off describing what the CBO options are. And we can have a more sort of philosophical discussion as to whether Congress currently falls in that Scrooge or Santa comparison. And so I think, Bob, we'll start with you. Why don't you give our listeners a quick summary and maybe an assessment of where Congress is right now?
Well, the CBO options book is one of our favorites. It comes out every year, and they present scored options for deficit reduction, either raising taxes or cutting spending. And they have some mandatory spending options, and they have discretionary spending options. And you can go through them and make your own budget or see how far you could come in closing the budget gap. I think it's a very interesting document. It's not an easy read. It's not a real page turner, but it's kind of fun to look at. every time I look at this book, it seems to me that I understand better why politicians don't want to do anything about the deficit, because it looks like there are a lot of hard choices here. Either anything to cut spending or raise taxes, you know, you end up looking more like Scrooge than you do like Santa Claus. And face it, if you're about to go to the voters, would you rather look like Scrooge or Santa Claus? So it seems to me that for politicians, the trick is, you know, how do you become either a soft-hearted Scrooge or a tough-love Santa? I'm not exactly sure.
A soft-hearted Scrooge.
Well, yeah, you're going to have, I don't know where you split the difference. But anyway, that's kind of the trick here, because a lot of these things, you read them at first, and your initial reaction is, well, I don't want to do that.
Well, Scrooge's heart did change over the course of A Christmas Carol, so I guess there is hope
that's
there, Bob,
true.
With what you had to say.
Ah, humbug.
Yeah. Well, and I'll say, Chase, that this list hasn't changed that much over the years. You know, I used to work at the CBO in the late 90s, and I had to put together some of the revenue options, at least, in this volume. And, you know, some of those come back year after year in the CBO. Very large volume of options to reduce the deficit. That's because it's not very difficult to come up with a list of proposals that actually make quite a bit of economic sense, and they're easy, you know, raise tax rates, reduce benefits. I mean, the math and the economics are actually quite straightforward and simple. And the, you know, reason we see these options come up year after year is because Congress never actually follows through and it takes any of CBO's ideas and turns them into law.
I was going to ask, you know, with your experience, how many of these policy options are economically feasible? And it sounds like many of them are, especially since many of them are recycled year after year because Congress doesn't act. And that goes into my more direct question, is how politically feasible or tenable are these options?
You know, I think by definition, the fact that they keep showing up as options and not fulfillments of options means that they haven't been politically feasible. I mean, the most productive in the deficit reduction sense of these proposals in the CBO volume would be considered kind of crazy to actually propose if you're a member of Congress. So
you also see that a lot of them don't really save
that much
money. You go through some of the discretionary spending options and look for options to eliminate programs or substantially scale back programs, and they'll save you 3, 4, 5, maybe even, if you're lucky, up to $10 billion over 10 years. And we have a projected increase in the debt of over $12 trillion.
Yes.
Over the coming 10 years. And so a lot of these things don't get you very far down that road.
That's actually, that might be a good transition to my own 12 options that I put together in sort of this 12 days of Christmas mindset. But before we make that transition, Bob, you just made a really good point, and I wanted to ask, why is it that a lot of these options don't have much savings attached to them?
Well, because a lot of them don't involve that much money. I mean, the big money in the budget, as we all know, is with the larger programs like Social Security and Medicare. This mandatory spending is somewhere around 62% of the budget, and then interest, which you can't just cut. I mean, you can't say, oh, my program is to cut interest this year. That's another 8% or so. So roughly around 70% of the budget is those big programs. So when you get into the weeds on smaller programs, even in the defense budget, which is not small, that's about 20% of the budget. It is a little bit less than 20%. But when you get into cutting individual weapon systems programs, it's not all that much. So you really have to do a lot on the discretionary side, probably an unrealistic amount, to get to any serious deficit reduction.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed that there wasn't an option to default on our debt just to wipe out that interest payment. Totally kidding. Let's kick it off. We'll start going through my 12 options now. And since we've been talking about discretionary spending, we'll start there. And just to let everyone know who's listening, the CBO options book has dozens of options in it, and I had a very hard time paring it down to 12. In fact, we use a lot of these options as the basis for our principles and priorities budget exercise, and we have over 40 options in that exercise. So paring it down to 12 was very difficult for me, and I tried to take some broader strokes on some of these policies. So since we're talking about discretionary first, the option that I started with is option one within the discretionary spending, and it was reducing the Department of Defense's budget 10% relative to the forecasted budget for 2022, and that saved $517 billion over 10 years. I know we were just talking about discretionary having a lot of small things, but this is one of their big options. Does this option make me a Scrooge or make me a Santa?
It makes you unpatriotic.
Oh, wow.
No, that's the charge that that certainly you would get there, shortchanging the nation's defense. That's kind of a, I don't know quite how to say this, it's an easy option in that you're not making individual choices there about programs, so that it does set a cap as to, you know, how much savings you would get. Presumably then you would go back to the Pentagon and say, you tell me how you're going to get there, which would be the way to do that. I mean, you know, if you're going to do it. So certainly I think that would be a popular choice in some areas, because we get that question a lot as to, you know, why are you talking about programs that help people like Social Security and Medicare? Why don't you talk about cutting the defense budget? So you certainly would get some support there. I don't, you know, you're certainly not a Santa, but I wouldn't call it a Scrooge.
Right. I think that it's hard for people to see the personal loss that they feel if the defense budget were cut, compared with if you had picked other programs. So let's hear the rest of your list.
Okay, so one of the other things I picked in discretionary was option four, and that was replacing some military personnel with civilian employees, saving about $14.2 billion over 10 years. Scrooge or Santa?
Well, you're a Scrooge to the military personnel, I suppose.
Santa to the civilian hires.
Exactly.
You can do both. I don't think you'd get too much of an argument on that one, except from at the micro level, like Diane said.
Mm-hmm. There's some redistribution there, yes.
Yeah, and I think that's the difficult part when I was looking at these options is, you know, everything that is picked is going to have some kind of negative ramification. Otherwise, they wouldn't be difficult choices like you were saying, Bob, and they wouldn't continually be
exactly
there to be recycled like you said, Diane. So this is me trying to make a tough choice, knowing that there's going to be negative ramifications. Next option in discretionary was option 32 within that category, reduce the size of the federal workforce through attrition. This is sort of similar to the previous option that I picked, and it would save about $35 billion over 10 years. Scrooge or Santa?
Not too much Scrooge here. I think there's the federal government's facing a challenge already in finding younger people to replace federal workers that are retiring. There's a definite, you know, reduction in supply overall and interest, it seems, among younger people to come to work for the federal government. So I actually think that it would naturally, there would be natural attrition. And it would not sort of put a lot of people out in terms of, wow, I really wanted that federal job and they're not replacing this person that's retiring.
Yeah, I think it's a perfectly reasonable option. It depends on two things. One, the function that the federal workforce is charged with carrying out and their productivity. If you're reducing the scope of the federal government, it's easier to reduce the workforce. If you're improving productivity, you can reduce the federal workforce through attrition. Seems to be the non-Scrooge way to go. And then the danger there is that you get a situation like, say, with the IRS, where they'd be giving more and more duties with a more complex tax code and less resources or fewer people to carry out those resources, so that it becomes easier for tax cheats, say,
that's
to get away
true
with what they're doing, because the IRS doesn't have the personnel to do it, and you get less responsive customer service,
that's
you might
true
say.
Yeah.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You're listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during our Economist Mom segment. We're having a holiday-themed 12 days of Christmas with the Congressional Budget Office options to reduce the deficit. And right now, I'm the guinea pig. I'm putting forward my 12 options for those 12 days and being told whether I'm a Scrooge or a Santa. And we actually need to pick up the pace a little bit. We're not even quite halfway through my 12 particular options. So let's switch gears here. I'm actually done with discretionary spending. And let's switch to mandatory spending. One of the options that I picked there was option 17 within that category, which would change the cost-sharing rules for Medicare and restrict Medigap insurance, and that would save about $44 billion over the course of 10 years. And within that option, there were actually two categories, and I opted to only do the cost-sharing rules change and not the limitation on Medigap insurance. Makes me a Scrooge, or does it make me a Santa?
Well, both. I mean, you're a Scrooge for... I like that option. I would have taken it. I would have taken both parts of it and limit the Medigap coverage also. I'd have been Scroogier than you.
Scroogier.
Okay, so let's see if you're Scroogier than me. On the next one I chose, and you're going to notice a theme here, option 18, which was increasing premiums for parts B and D of Medicare, and it would save about $389 billion over 10 years. Scrooge or Santa?
I think that's obviously a Scrooge to the Medicare recipients, but it's, you know, one of those easy ways to be a Scrooge.
Well,
it's an easy Scrooge. Economically easy.
Okay.
Policy easy, not politically easy.
Next one, trying to crank through these as quickly as possible. Option number 19 within mandatory spending, raising the age of eligibility for Medicare up to 67 over the three-month period time frame as opposed to the two-month period each year, saving $21.8 billion over 10 years. Scrooge or Santa?
These aren't too bad. I mean, all these are being Scrooges to old people, not to young people, right? You know, that is a very sensible way to deal with the demographic challenge, which is, of course, what's driving all our imbalance in terms of the big mandatory spending programs relative to our revenues. So,
if you notice about that one, it doesn't get as much money as a lot of people think, because the money in Medicare is not with 65 to 67-year-olds who are still relatively healthy.
It's the older.
It's with the older.
Yeah.
So, and also, the thing is, if you still have the exchanges in place, Obamacare made it easier to do this because there's some way that people that are over 65 or over 62 or might be retired that aren't eligible yet for Medicare would still have some place to go to get reasonably priced health insurance. So you would have to, I think if you were going to do this option, you'd want to make sure that there was something like Obamacare still in place so that people just wouldn't fall into a gap where they would retire and they would have no health insurance, you know, when they were 65.
Yeah.
So there's some problems with the option, but it is in keeping with the changing demographics.
Yeah, dealing with demographics.
And we'll stay on that note here as I shift to a couple Social Security options, one in the mandatory spending area and the other switching to the revenue side. I picked option 31 in mandatory spending, raising the full age of retirement for Social Security, which would save $28.2 billion over 10 years. And then the revenue side, I picked option 20, which would increase the maximum taxable earnings for Social Security in terms of the payroll tax to cover 90% of wages throughout the nation. And that would save about $785 billion over 10 years. Those two options with regard to Social Security, do they make me a Scrooge or a Santa?
You're being the third rail Scrooge there, right? Yeah.
You're riding the third rail. Two thumbs up. I like them.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're preaching to the choir here, to the Christmas choir here, Chase. But, you know, we see those options. Those are kind of the bread and butter CBO options that show up year after year.
I think both of those would be part of some sort of bipartisan Social Security reform plan. I'm pretty sure they would.
Well, that's good. Maybe that'll make me a somewhat of a soft-hearted Scrooge then. I'm a little bipartisan in how I approach that particular issue.
you're a tough-love Santa.
Oh, I'm a tough-love Santa. I like that even better. All right, so I'm going to try, and we're running out of time here. I'm going to try and pool a few of the revenue options that I picked. A couple of them are pretty big options in terms of revenue generators, so I'll just rattle them off. Option 30, increase the excise tax on tobacco products by 50%, bringing in 41.
What, are you crazy?
I knew you would say that, Bob. For all those who don't know, Bob is an avid cigar smoker, so that would hit him particularly hard. I also opted for option 31, increase the excise taxes on motor fuels and index for inflation, and I picked the 15-cent option in that tax, which would bring in $237 billion over 10 years. I also picked a fun one. I have one more after this, but I'm going to save that for a little snippet, like a little asterisk and side note. But the other one I'm going to put in this pool here is option 40, increasing the appropriations for the IRS in terms of enforcement initiatives, bringing in $35 billion over 10 years. So what do you guys think of those four things I pulled together, knowing I've got one more to bring up, Scrooge or Santa?
All good options.
Yeah, they're, I think that those are kind of smart Scrooge options again, because I noticed maybe you have an income tax option in your back pocket still, but they're all kind of avoiding just raising income tax rates or getting rid of or broadening the income tax base. And I think that one thing that we're seeing in the data is it's becoming increasingly difficult for us to get revenue out of the income tax system. And so I believe that the wave of the future that we, in terms of raising more revenue, is going to have to expand the amount we tax consumption of specific goods or goods more generally. And, you know, we might be also looking at adding a tax base like a carbon tax base. I just think that we're reaching our limits in our capacity to tax income. And then coupled, of course, with the fact that Congress wants to just keep giving away, they keep wanting to be Santa with the income tax. And so whatever we have left in the income tax is seems like it's not going to last for very long because they just want to keep cutting it. So I think we have to get creative and we have to be looking at consumption taxes of various types.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head there, Diane. My last tax or revenue piece isn't, it's on the carbon tax side, not necessarily the general tax code or the corporate tax. And it's largely because I didn't like the options that were available through CBO in this particular rendition, because I've always sort of bought into the idea of a broadening of the base, simplifying of the code, getting rid of the deductions and exclusions. I felt like the options that were in CBO touched on some aspects of that, but it wasn't that wholehearted big tax code reform I wanted to see. So I opted, because I only had 12 that I could pick for this exercise, was the option 35 in the revenue, which was imposing a tax on emissions of greenhouse gases. Brings in about $1 trillion over 10 years. But here is my asterisk. I don't know that we would get the $1 trillion savings with what I would want to do with it, and that would be to channel some of that revenue into infrastructure investment and maybe a dividend back to some of the citizens throughout the nation. So even though it has on the CBO option marked as $1 trillion in savings, I doubt the way I would want to structure it that it would actually get there. Santa or Scrooge?
Yeah, in order to get it passed, you would have to do something similar to what you suggested. And my prediction is you would also have to do what Diane just said, which is on the income tax side, there would have to be a cut in the income tax. Not that they would have to be economically, I'm just saying politically, if you were going to add a new tax, like a carbon tax, there would probably have to be some sort of Santa effect to the Scrooge effect.
To wrap up this part of the show, if we were to put all of my options together that I picked and exclude the carbon tax, I would have saved about $2.15 trillion over 10 years. If we took the carbon tax into consideration. Yeah, thanks. Well, I mean, it's good in the sense that it saves some money and bridges some of the deficits. But Bob mentioned we've got, what, $12 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years, and I'm barely scraping it with a little over two. And if we took the carbon tax straight as is in this option, it would, you know, put me up over the $3 trillion mark. But we already mentioned that I don't think I'd get there with how I'd want to structure it anyway. So we got a little more political, at least from my perspective, in terms of I actually had to put my pen to paper and pick some options and make the hard choices. I don't think I'd actually get reelected if I were a member of Congress picking all these options, but I tried my best to find a balance in some of the things that we were doing and have sort of a long-term perspective in mind. And before we end this segment here, Diane, I wanted to ask both you and Bob, in the holiday theme, are there any long-term wish list items in terms of gifts, if you want to put it in that category, that you would like to see Congress working on? Or is there anything in terms of policy measures or CBO options that we're just sort of re-gifting going into the next Congress?
Well, under the re-gifting category, I would only count as gifts things that actually raise the deficit, not reduce the deficit. And so the one that comes to mind is the fact that in current law, we have a lot of tax cuts that expire every year and that are routinely extended. But those would not count as revenue-raising options if we let them expire, because they're already built into the CBO baseline. So what we're going to see is a lot of re-gifting, because we're going to see a lot of those tax cuts extended, as they always are.
And I'd say if you want to rush out to the store, Congress, and get a last-minute gift, don't shut down the government. Try to have a short-term budget deal by the end of this week that would bring a Merry Christmas to federal workers that don't want to be laid off without pay. You got to do this anyway, so that's the last-minute shopping. It's not a long-term thing, but they need to do it. And longer-term, they need to work on health care costs containment, which is not just as a matter of just automatic spending cuts or automatic premium increases or something like that. The key thing is under, trying to slow the underlying cost growth of healthcare. There are a lot of areas that might help do that, and that's what I'd like to see them working on when they get back to healthcare policy.
And I'd like to see them keep working on new sources of revenue. It would be nice if in the long term we actually paid for what we, for the government that we want.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during the holiday edition of the Economist Mom segment. Thank you both for joining the show once again, and have a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, Diane and Bob.
Happy Holidays to everyone.
Happy Holidays, listeners.
Look forward to having you both back in a few weeks. Up next, policy analyst for the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, Bill Sletten, will join me to discuss state budget policy and crossover with federal issues. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute policy analyst Bill Sletten. Before working with NHFPI, Phil served as a performance auditor for New Hampshire Office of Legislative Budget Assistant. He was born and raised in New Hampshire, has a bachelor's in political science and policy studies from Grinnell College, and a master's of public affairs from the University of Wisconsin. He has graced the airwaves of Facing the Future before, and we're happy to have him with us again today. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you very much, Chase.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you and get an update on some state fiscal policy. So that's what we're going to talk largely about today, and maybe get a little bit into the crossover with federal policy or revenues. Before we dive into that headlong, I do want to back up a step and hear from you a little bit about your role with NHFPI and sort of the goal or purpose of the organization itself.
The New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute really wants to inform the public policy debate in New Hampshire. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan, independent policy research organization based in Concord, and we study budget and tax and revenue policy in the state, as well as the state economy and economic policy and healthcare policy. We do that with a focus on low and moderate income people, making sure that they are a part of the policy debate as well. Basically, we want to make sure that our legislators and our journalists and our public is informed about the policy issues facing New Hampshire. Now, my role is that I'm a policy analyst, which means that any sort of policy question that's in that purview is something that I might be tackling in the course of my work, which is very interesting. And there's a lot of different types of policy that intersect with New Hampshire state government. And it's fun and interesting to be able to tackle it all, especially the fiscal policy side that we'll talk about today.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to the Concord Coalition in terms of its purpose and goal, except it obviously has a state focus. So let's jump in. I wanted to get a better understanding, help our listeners understand what the state budget process is even like. What's it entail? How long does it take? What does it cover? Give us that sort of broad sweeping summary of the budget process in the state.
So the state's operating budget, which is the budget, when most people think about the state budget, they're thinking about what is paying for ongoing state operations. And that is a two-year budget. So it is passed once per every legislative term. And the state budget is basically, it's $6 billion roughly each year. So it's a $12 billion document. Again, that's roughly about what it was. This current operating budget, next operating budget will probably be about the same. And that budget is the largest single policy document that any legislator, for example, passes that votes on in their time in office, barring something very unforeseen, right? So it is where the funding is directed for most state agency operations. It's directed through the state budget. Now, the process for creating the state budget, remember it's a two-year state budget, actually takes about a year of that two-year state budget. So you're about halfway through the budget, and the state agencies have already started planning for the next budget in some cases. They have to take revenue projections that are estimated by the governor's office on August 1st of the year before the state legislature decides on the next budget. So there are basically five phases. And I should say that the state budget is usually decided in the first 6 months of an odd-numbered year. So there's an election in an even-numbered year, the new legislature comes in and will decide on a state budget in the first 6 months of an odd-numbered year, such as this year coming up, 2019. So prior to that, in that even numbered year, in the summer before the state agencies are working on their state budgets, they get revenue projections from the governor's office that allow them to build certain parts of their budget and essentially have a target to sort of shoot for in terms of how much they're going to spend in their budget requests. They then submit their budget requests to the governor. The governor then produces a state budget plan and has to deliver that to the legislature by February 15th. So that next February, when the legislature and the new members of the legislature, and if there's a new governor, the new governor are in place, they have to submit their budget to the legislature by the 15th. That finishes the governor's phase, which is the second phase. The third phase is the House phase. The House of Representatives first takes a look at the state budget and usually takes the governor's platform and takes the governor's budget as sort of a basis for how they're going to make amendments, make those amendments, make the changes that they see fit. Once they are finished with their version of the budget, if they pass it, then it moves on to the state Senate. The state Senate's the fourth phase of the state budget process, and the state Senate then puts together its version of the state budget. The final phase is when the Senate and the House get a committee of conference together, which has members from the House and the Senate, and decide on a final version of the state budget. And then that final version has to pass through both legislative chambers, both the House and the Senate, before it is either signed or vetoed or allowed to become law without the governor's signature. That's another mechanism here in New Hampshire. It then becomes law ideally by July 1st, because that's usually when the budget that was the prior operating budget runs out of authority. So by July 1st, you want to have that new state budget in place so that you can have a two-year operating budget plan for the next two state fiscal years.
That sounds like a very elaborate process that is very detail-oriented. Does it ever have hiccups along the way? Like, is there ever a point where it gets stuck in one of those cogs and has a hard time in getting back on track?
Absolutely. There have been times where one legislative body has spent more time with the state budget than was originally planned. Usually they try and split the time at least somewhat evenly between the House and the Senate, depending on a couple different factors in their calendars. Sometimes there have been times in the past where the House has kept the budget for a longer period of time, in agreement with the Senate, for example. There have also been times, like this last budget cycle, where the House did not pass its own version of the state budget, and then the state Senate picked up the governor's budget and amended a different piece of legislation with the governor's budget. There have also been instances where the governor has vetoed the budget, and that, because there's only so much time between the Committee of Conference and July 1st, usually there's not very much time in there, so there's not necessarily time for the legislature to go craft a new budget or make those changes. And if there aren't, then what may happen, and what has happened in the past, is the legislature will pass a continuing resolution or sort of a more temporary spending bill that will continue the operating budget from before that, the operating budget that they have in place at the time that they agreed to 2 years from 2 years prior, continue that forward, you know, maybe 3 months or 6 months, for example.
And Phil, you mentioned a couple times that this process sort of kicks off with some revenue projections by the governor's office, which sounds very similar to the federal level. Everything is reliant upon I guess not everything, because we do tend to have pretty large deficits. But in large part, understanding how big those deficits are going to be is reliant upon revenue projections. So I guess a question that I had in relation to that is, are those revenue projections relied upon throughout the entire process? Are they always realistic or relatively on par? Or is that sometimes more a political measure than anything else?
So there are five sets of revenue projections that are actually developed throughout the process by five different groups of people.
All right.
One is the governor's revenue projections that go to the state agencies that help them craft their budgets. The next set is the governor's revenue projections that come out with the governor's budget plan. And note that those could be two separate governors, because there is an election in between. But they are also at two different time periods, so there's more information about what's happening with state revenues during those times. The House, the House Ways and Means Committee, also develops sets of revenue estimates that then the full chamber adopts through a resolution, and that resolution will then inform the House's version of the state budget. The Senate has its own Senate Ways and Means Committee that will also develop revenue projections for its version of the state budget. And then the Committee of Conference will decide on a final set of revenue projections. So you have five different sets of revenue projections that potentially involve five completely different sets of people. They don't always involve completely different sets of people, but they can, which means that you can have relatively different, especially if we're talking about, you know, tens of millions of dollars of difference, relatively different revenue projections at different times for a variety of factors, one of which is they're made at different times in the process. If you make them months apart, the state revenue picture could look relatively different depending on what's happening in the economy and what's happening with state revenue.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I've been talking to Phil Sletten from the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Right now we're talking about state fiscal policy, and I want to continue along those lines, Phil. I mentioned that we often have budget deficits at the federal level, and I've heard that New Hampshire is, in, at least in some respect, required to have a balanced budget. So can you explain that aspect of the process for us, and is it true that, and I've even heard people say there's a constitutional requirement that New Hampshire balances its budget. So give us a summary of what that looks like, and am I on the right track with what I'm saying here?
The New Hampshire legislature is required to approve a state budget that only appropriates as much as planned revenues are. And that requirement is in statute. It's not in the Constitution, but it's in statute and is generally followed, right? The legislature would have to change that statute to be able to pass a budget that would be, for example, out of balance, where revenues and expenditures don't match. Now, there are some caveats there. One is that the legislature often assumes that the budget lines, the actual line items, are going to be underspent by a certain amount. It's actually called a lapse amount. So the legislature makes an assumption that the state agency, for example, is going to underspend its budget by 3%, right? That requirement is in there as an assumption, but it is something that's expected so that the state agency can seek efficiencies, you know, within the framework of the budget that it's given. So the legislature is allowed to, it has allowed itself in statute to pass a budget that does balance based on a lapse assumption. That being said, it's not written anywhere in law per se exactly what that assumption is. That isn't written into the state budget itself. But generally, yes, the legislature is required to pass a budget that balances. Those lapses are sometimes large dollar amounts, but as a percentage of the budget, we're not talking about 10 or 20%, for example, of the budget.
And you mentioned earlier, Phil, if I'm remembering correctly, that the budget process touches everything that's sort of the operating budget for the state. By statute, it's required to balance. There's some give and take a little bit there with some lapse that you just mentioned. Does the state carry any debt? And if it does, what's that look like?
Yes, the state does carry debt, and you make a good distinction there between the operating budget and other spending authorization. There is a separate capital budget, for example, which as opposed to being a two-year operating budget, which has to balance revenues with expenditures during that two-year period. The state capital budget is a six-year budget, and there's sort of a check-in and a readjustment or an opportunity to readjust it every 2 years. So every legislature sort of gets a chance to make its changes. But the capital budget can rely on borrowed dollars. It doesn't necessarily have to be revenue that comes in at that period of time. It can rely on a bond or the state borrowing money to fund certain capital expenditures. So here we're talking about, you know, things like changes to buildings and larger projects along those lines. Sometimes IT infrastructure, information technology infrastructure is included there. The 10-year transportation improvement plan is also a separate piece of legislation that authorizes a plan for spending money on transportation projects for the next 10-year period. Again, there's a check-in every 2 years, but those are dollars that, again, these are for capital-intensive projects that and bonds are often authorized to do things like road construction and building new bridges and infrastructure. There's also other appropriations that are authorized through other pieces of legislation outside of the budget. So, for example, if you want to pass, if you're a legislator and you want to fund a priority of yours in a non-budget year, or even in a budget year, you don't necessarily have to put that piece of legislation in the state budget or amend the state budget. You can pass it in a separate piece of legislation if you can find the funding for it.
In line with that, does the state have any limitations on how much debt it can carry with some of these investment plans or separate bills, or perhaps a limit on debt service itself?
There isn't, to my knowledge, there's not any sort of statutory limit on generally this is how much, you know, sort of liability the state can carry relative to its assets. You know, there are other areas, for example, with pension liabilities, right, where if the state doesn't match its pension growth targets and investment targets, and the Pew Charitable Trusts have done some multi-state analyses of these, then you have more liabilities than you have assets in sort of that pension category. So that's another place where you'd have to fund that through a different mechanism, for example, if that mechanism doesn't change. So there's a fair bit of opportunity for the state to accrue sort of different areas where there may be debt. That being said, for a lot of those other bills, a lot of those bills outside the state budget, those are often funded with revenue surplus dollars. So the state budget's passed, there's a state revenue plan, and if a legislator wants to pass a different piece of legislation, they might say, well, the state revenue plan is actually being exceeded by actual revenues. So we have a little bit of extra money that we could use that's not being used in the state budget, and they might try and use some of those surplus dollars to fund a new piece of legislation that's outside the state budget. So that's not accruing new debt. That's using revenue that wasn't anticipated in the state revenue plan.
So we've been talking a little bit about these different, piles of money and piles of spending and different ways the state goes at it and what process touches on what aspects of the government. Does the federal government provide any revenue that benefits the state's budget? Because I know the state doesn't have, in a traditional sense, a sales or income tax. They have a business tax and property taxes and sort of a sales tax on, I think it's prepared foods and stuff like
meals
that.
Meals and rentals,
meals
yes.
and rentals. So do we get any outside help? And if so, how much?
Absolutely, we get outside help. About a third of the state's operating expenditures, and that's a rough number, but about $1 in $3 that the state spends on ongoing state operations come through federal transfers. Specifically, the state budget is about 30% federal funds, about 30% funded through federal funds, I should say. The largest area on that front is Medicaid. Medicaid is a state-federal fiscal partnership that helps pay for health coverage for low-income people generally, as well as certain other populations. Again, folks facing low incomes or who have limited assets. It's basically a matching program. So for most of the Medicaid program, the state government puts in $1, the federal government supplies $1, and those $2 go to pay for health coverage for low-income people in the state. Now, that was a $2.1 billion program, if you count all expenditures at the state and federal level that were attributed to New Hampshire in state fiscal year 2016. And again, over half of that comes from the federal government. So that is the largest single program. However, there are other programs that are targeted at low-income people. The food stamps program in the state, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program at the federal level, all those benefits are paid with federal dollars. The Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families is another program that's a block grant program that comes from where those dollars come from the federal government. This time of year in New Hampshire, we're thinking about the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which funds the state fuel assistance program and helps people keep their homes warm. And then federal transportation aid is another big area. There are a myriad of programs there that bring tens of millions of dollars into the state to help with our transportation infrastructure, often with very favorable matches for the state, with the federal government paying for large portions of projects. Education aid, there's a certain amount for certain purposes there. And there are also environmental programs, particularly targeted at clean water and drinking water. Those are just some examples of the largest federal programs that help fund the state operations.
So it sounds like what happens at the federal level could have a very real impact on programming at the state level for us.
Absolutely.
I wanted to go sort of full circle with our discussion and take a step back and ask, what are some of the fiscal policy challenges that the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute sees for the state over the next couple of years?
Right. So the big one is that in terms of what could be coming over the next couple of years is whether there's going to be a recession or not. That can affect revenues quite a bit. And that is something that we've had to, in the last recession, the legislature had to come back and create a new sort of supplemental budget to address the revenue shortfalls that the state faced. Medicaid reimbursement rates, how much people are paid for services if they are providing services to people with Medicaid coverage. That's going to be a big issue this legislative session. Revenue projections overall will be difficult, not just because of the recession, but because of some of the changes that we've seen following the federal tax overhaul late last year. Education funding is maybe going to be a big question this session, and that's $900 million a year, so adjustments to that could have a big fiscal impact. There's also paid family medical leave, combating the opioid crisis, supporting the state's mental health system, and the overall relationship between the state government and local governments. These are all questions that could potentially have a big fiscal impact and are examples of where we could decide to make spending priorities in our state budget that reflect our values as a society and as a community. The state budget affects everyone's lives in some ways, and these are some areas where they could have a big positive impact on people's lives, and a lot of those positive impacts do have dollar figures associated with them, and that will be a big part of the debate for this coming session that will help guide us through the next couple of years.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Phil Sletten discuss state fiscal policy as well as some federal crossover. Phil, thanks again for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and happy new year. Thanks for listening.